Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. This week's episode features a conversation on the role of the intelligence agencies in U.S. national security. To explore the topic, I sat down with General Michael Hayden. He's the former director of the National Security Agency and the CIA. This event was recorded before a World Affairs audience in San Francisco, and the broadcast is made possible by the generous support of Chevron. And now to our conversation.
Good evening, and thank you for joining us and for welcoming General Michael Hayden. He is a four-star. He was in the Air Force, but just to show how open-minded Marines Memorial is, you are particularly welcomed here. He's the highest-ranking military intelligence officer. He both headed the NSA and headed the CIA, as you know, and of course he was there in the thick of things during some pretty big pivot points in our history, from 9/11 to investments in new kinds of technologies to Iraq and Afghanistan, a little bit of what happened in Iran, but we'll say more about that as we go. But most importantly for tonight's conversation, he is the author of a new book called Playing on the Edge. And so we'll kind of start with that edge a little bit. Actually, we'll start with what's in the news right now. And we'll stay in the news because it does have a little something to do with being on the edge. And that is this great big dump of what's purported to be CIA materials, yeah, describing our capabilities when it comes to surveillance. And so I wanted to kind of start with what technical capabilities we have, who else has them, and then move to the sort of the policy permissions, the legal constraints that exist.
So three or four broad observations. First, just forgive me, I got to do it this way, all right? I can't confirm or deny how genuine those may or may not be. But based on press reporting, it reveals several things. Number one, you're getting something for your $53 billion every year that you give to the intelligence community. These are all actually the kinds of things you would expect espionage services to do. All right, so that's one. Number two, even WikiLeaks is having problems trying to express some involvement of U.S. person privacy in these tools. I know I got a Samsung TV, all right? I got an iPhone in my pocket, but there is no evidentiary trail inside these documents, which were purloined, so these have not been being controlled by the U.S. government. There is no evidentiary trail that these tools have been used for anything other than what you want them to be used for, is to go after people who are legitimate intelligence targets of the United States to keep America and her friends more safe. It does raise a couple of issues, though, all right? Number one, look, we're all Americans. We all come from the same value base. We all live in the same political culture. We all distrust government power. Now, that's just who we are. It makes an American kind of double clutch when they realize its espionage services have the tools to penetrate devices that are in common use by Americans. All right, I know these people. They're not coming after you or your data. And again, there's no stack of evidence, and even WikiLeaks claims that they're coming after American data. And I guess the last point I'd make, and very briefly, even when your intelligence services are doing what you want them to do, even when they're doing it for the highest of purposes, even when they're really good at it, it is not an unfair question to ask whether they should be doing it if they can't keep their tools secret. All right, so even if you assume everything, if you believe everything I just said, good people, good purposes, a lot of talent, I mean, they've just created things now that are bleeding out into the public domain, where they will not only make it more difficult for us to do our work, it will make it easier for other people to misuse them.
That's right.
And so that is a non-trivial question for my old tribe.
So I want to take you to who else has this capability. Should we assume that China, Russia, Israel, maybe Iran has this kind of capability to break through in the encryption?
Sure. You would think that a country of this wealth and this country's technological expertise, and for God's sake, we invented the thing, all right, that we would be better at it than anyone else. In my professional judgment, without any bragging, is we are. All right? There are a couple other countries that are actually quite good at it. So I've got the Americans, and I frankly would put them in a class by themselves, by expertise and by scale. All right? The next strongest power doing this, I would put the Russians, who have skill, and then the Chinese, who have scale, okay, and then the others begin to trail off. The British are quite good at this. The Israelis, good but more narrow in what they do, and so yeah, we're good at this.
Now the but the constraints. Are we to understand that if a conversation is monitored in some way, yeah, that one person in that conversation is not an American?
So I'm going to be really efficient, but this is not a question that can be answered with the what my Army buddies call the big hand, little map wave, you know? All right? So that in order to target the communications of an American require an order from a federal judge. It cannot be authorized by the president. So that takes us back to the last 10 days of American history. So that when somebody would ask me, can you guarantee me that the government wasn't targeting Donald Trump's phone? My response is, I can guarantee you that our government wasn't. There are so many diplomatic missions in New York. Well, okay, we'll just leave it there. So that if you want to target an American's communication, you got to go to a court. Now that said, in the modern world, when we target somebody you want us to target, all right, someone that is a legitimate intelligence target of the United States, there are occasions when in doing that well-defined, legal, necessary task, we will intercept information to, from, or about what we call a U.S. person. Now, everyone in this room is a U.S. person. The definition is any American anywhere and anyone in the United States. And when we are doing our legitimate work, and we get information to, from, or about a protected U.S. person, we are required to minimize the U.S. identity. We're not required to hang up. We are required to protect the U.S. identity so that when we report the information, we will say that, the foreign minister of country X, in an extended conversation with a named U.S. person, da-da-da-da-da, and we keep the U.S. person's identity minimized, is the term we use, or masked, unless, of course, the U.S. person's identity is the actual intelligence. And so if the foreign minister of country X then says, I really want to thank you for the purloined documents, we'd put the name in. To put you at ease, this isn't Trump, this isn't Bush. It's Truman. This is how it's been done since the foundation of the agency in 1952. So to fast forward the DVR here, Sergei Kislyak, the Russian ambassador, it probably wasn't hard to prove to a court that he was an agent of a foreign power. And so one might assume that as the Russian ambassador, he would be a legitimate intelligence target. So that if he were to talk to an American, even, and again, I'm just reflecting what I'm reading in the paper, even the National Security Advisor designate, that phone call would be covered if Kislyak was indeed a target of NSA surveillance.
So even if that person were Michael Flynn, Roger Stone, Paul Manafort,
Who
Jeff Sessions?
Yeah.
Who else has recently discovered that they had one of these conversations?
Well, I mean, some of those are face-to-face contacts, all right? Yeah. But to use them in an illustrative way,
yes.
Okay, if they are talking to a legitimate foreign intelligence target, we don't need a court order to do our foreign job, all right? That's covered by different aspects of American law. If the American is in contact, the American deserves privacy. The American's name is minimized unless it is required for the understanding of the intelligence.
So do I deduce from this that President Trump is either blowing smoke. He's either just reciting what he saw on Breitbart, or...
I'm going with A, but go ahead. You can give me a B.
Or he had a conversation with the Russians.
Or someone. Yeah, sure.
Okay.
But again, the accusation was not that someone related to the Trump campaign. By the way, that when you pick up the two from or about, that is called incidental collection. All right. He didn't make the claim that someone he liked was involved in incidental collection. The claim in the four tweets was targeting.
Right. Which is, and targeting himself.
Well, he said he didn't quite get there. You could get there by extension, all right? But you know, 140 characters, you can't get into details.
So but there were multiple of them. Well, so what do you expect will happen on the Hill? I mean, here you've had probably more experience with the House and Senate Intelligence Committees than any other single person I can think of.
Yeah, and always pleasant, I might add.
Oh,
yeah.
So here, this claim that the former president, President Obama, approved wiretapping in Trump Tower, that's now being pushed over to the Senate Intelligence Committee as part of their investigation Russian hacking in an effort to influence the elections. How hard is this going to be for the committee? It seems like it's in a very tough spot.
It is a tough spot. Look, we are off the map here, all right? We've got no national experience in... Oh, let's check out how we did this back in 1920. This has never happened. So you've got, you've got good people trying to figure out what is the best political, in the best sense of that word, political, legal, and public way forward. So the two heads of the Senate committee, Richard Burr from North Carolina and Senator Warner from Virginia, check, good folks. All right? And they've said, no, we're going to go take this on. So if you're asking my counsel, all right. My counsel is give him a chance. Let him go ahead and run it.
Yeah.
All right. Let's see how this goes. By the way, I've got to add, when this comes out 10 days ago, all right, anybody in my background says that can't be possible. The president can't authorize this. All right. Mm-hmm. And then it comes out on Saturday. But by Sunday, look, there are only two ways you get the judge to say, sure, it's OK. All right. One is through a foreign intelligence lane. He's an agent of a foreign power. The other is through a counterintelligence or law enforcement claim. Okay? He's involved in a crime. And you have to prove to a judge to a level of probable cause that he's foreign agent of a foreign power or involved in a crime. Right? The meister of this lane is Jim Clapper. The meister of this lane is Jim Comey. Right? Both have said they didn't do it. So we're out of Schlitz, all right? There's no other way. There's no other way to get a warrant. Yeah. And so this was very obvious. And then today, you've got poor Sean Spicer saying, wiretapping? Wiretapping? Who said wiretapping? it was a metaphor. Come on, people, work with us. more troubling. I'm not being lighthearted here. And I may be overreacting, okay? So don't take this to the bank. But the Department of Justice late this afternoon Eastern time also said that they were not yet prepared to be responsive to the Intelligence Committee's request for information and need to look longer to see if they have any more responsive documents. That could very well be true. It also could be that they're trying to cover a political backside down the street. Mm-hmm. And that's off-putting and a bit discomforting.
So let's get to the heart of the committee's work, and that is to look at Russia's role in our election.
Yeah.
The hacking of both the Republican National Committee and the Democratic National Committee, and the releasing to WikiLeaks of one set of that, of the DNC wiretaps. What kind of evidence do we have that they're doing something similar in Europe? There's some very key elections going on there.
Yeah, no,
as well.
No, I really don't know. I don't go back in to get briefings and so on. But to quickly rehearse what happened here, all right, which is no longer in doubt, that the Russians security services, probably with the assistance of Russian criminal gangs and cyber militias, so they could have, you know, a plausible deniability, hacked into the DNC, stole emails, stole Colin Powell's emails, stole John Podesta's emails. By the way, I got to admit, all right, so far, all that is honorable state espionage. Okay, that's adult nations do that to one another all the time. And if I'm the former, if I'm the director of NSA, and I could hack in to the emails of the leadership of United Russia, which is Vladimir Putin's party, and they actually were saying anything I cared about, okay, game on. That's what nation states do.
It's the WikiLeaks part.
But when you then take the product of honorable state espionage and you use it more than just to understand your adversary, but then to roll it back into your adversary's political space, then you got something more. And what the Russians did was they washed the emails through WikiLeaks. They set up their own site called DC Leaks. And then they created a bunch of trolls on the web that, in essence, treated the data in a way that the Google algorithms sensed the data was leading data and pulled the information they had pushed into the web up high so that your search engines, everyone's search engines, went to it as trending information. They did it, first of all, to mess with our heads. They were successful. They then did it to punish Hillary Clinton, who Vladimir Putin hates. They then did it to delegitimize and make weak the inevitable President Hillary Clinton. And then August-ish, probably September-ish, they began to realize maybe it's not so inevitable. And then they began to put their thumb on the scale. The activity was identical. The motivation shifted. They began to put their thumb on the scale, hoping, supporting a Trump victory. What I've just told you is a high-confidence judgment of the entire American intelligence community, a judgment that even the Trump campaign finally and reluctantly accepted in January. Now, I have to quickly add, there is no way of knowing. It's not that we don't know, it's that it is unknowable whether or not that it influenced anything. And therefore, Donald Trump is the legitimate 45th president of the United States, and we're done talking about that issue.
Right.
But the Russians did do this, that we know. They're not investigating that. That's already concluded. What they are looking at is, can we learn anything more about that? Can we share it with our European friends? And then, is there anything more that we should be aware of? Were there any kind of connections between that line of activity I laid out for you and the campaigns themselves? All right, and that's a hard question and a really serious one. But that's what they've taken on. Remember, I told you we're off the map. Okay? You got two political parties, one who really wants not to believe that, and one who really does want to believe that. And they now have got to do this honest look and let the facts take them where they may.
Let me hang on to a word you used there, a verb, and that's to delegitimize.
Yeah.
There seem to be a lot of forces that are having that impact.
Yeah.
That are leading folks to have a declining trust in their institutions and processes of governance, but also even in each other, and a loss of trust in the independent media. Or, you know, sort of, if you take the various elements of a liberal democracy, there our institutions are being called into question.
Yeah. They are.
And certainly the intelligence community is being called into question. A lot of suggestions that any leak of intelligence information is coming from the intelligence agencies.
Right.
Yet you're sharing it, or you used to share this information with a broad swath of people on the Hill and in the executive branch. How concerned are you about the delegitimization of these various institutions and sources of independent analysis in our government?
So far, the line of questioning here has me reasonably negative about certain trends in the current government, and we're going to get to some positive things, I'm sure, before we're done. But unfortunately, you've asked another question, and there does appear to be an approach by the current administration to not argue the facts of the case, but to attack the fact bearers. Okay, so you got the so-called judge. you got the dishonest media, you got fake news, and then you've got intelligence, which is always put in quotes inside the tweets. It's an unfortunate aspect of the first 50 days, and one that I firmly hope we can quickly get beyond. The intelligence community exists, and the only reason it exists is to make the president wiser and smarter than he would otherwise be. And so my guys, well, here, let me, I'm sorry, I'm going to give you a bit of a longish answer, but I think it's really important to put this into context. Like I said, I feel like I'm relentlessly negative up here, and I don't want to be, I don't need to be, all right? So there is always a dynamic between the, I'm going to use guy, between the intel guy and the policy guy, okay? Between the president's PDB briefer, president's daily brief, and the president. Right. And what you need is a mind merge. All right. The intel bearer has got to get into the head of the president. That is always a bit of a challenge. See, so you got the oval here, and it's a cartoon, all right? So the intel guy comes through the door marked facts. President comes through another door. He comes through a door marked vision. You know, the one you voted for him or her for. All right. Fact, vision. World as it is, world as we want it to be. Inherently inductive, see your data, general conclusions. Inherently deductive, first principles, how do I apply it? Fact, vision, inductive, deductive, as is, want to be. Inherently pessimistic. Bob Gates, who was one of my predecessors before he became SecDef, Bob has a wonderful phrase. He says, when a CIA analyst stops to smell the flowers, she then looks around for the hearse, okay? Inherently pessimistic, inherently optimistic, otherwise he or she would never have interviewed for the job. Yeah. I can make the world better. See the tension? Okay. Exists all the time. Now, we knew by November 9th that this particular dynamic was going to be even more challenging than average with President Trump. Because he is more intuitive. He is almost preternaturally confident in his own instincts. He has his own a priori narrative of how the world works. And before you get too judgmental, that's all that stuff that got him elected, okay? In the face of the experts who said, it ain't gonna be so. So we always knew that forever challenge, how do you get into the head of the new president, was actually going to be peculiarly difficult with this president just because of the human being that God made him to be. It is a great national tragedy that our first opportunity to address that conflict turned out to be on an issue that was being used by other Americans to challenge his legitimacy as president of the United States of America, the Russian intervention. It was a perfect storm. Mm. And we in the community and the president, I think, are still trying to dig out of the ill will that was created by those very peculiar and very dark circumstances.
Yeah. And I also would argue that this decline in trust precedes.
Oh, yes, I know. It is generalized throughout the government. So remember Edward Snowden? And all that stuff, right? Yeah, actually, if you could just sit down with me for a couple of days, I can explain all of it, okay? And I'm pretty sure most of you would be okay with it. Now, occasionally you disagree. That's okay. I got that. These are hard questions. But what happened was the Snowden leaks went out in an almost perfect storm of government distrust. All right. It went out there with a whole bunch of other things that were out there creating a lack of trust in the government, in the executive, in executive overreach. I have a pen, I have a phone, the IRS thing, I could go on. But it was all out there. And so when Snowden comes out and we say, no, that's just the government trying to be helpful, that is not a winning argument, okay, in that kind of atmosphere.
As you think about this, there's this sort of post 9/11 era, where the immediate response is, why didn't you do more? Why didn't you know more? Why didn't you communicate better? And what the heck are you going to do about it tomorrow?
Yeah.
That's a moment when the institutions are put under tremendous pressure to produce.
Yeah.
Right. But also to stretch the limits.
Yeah.
Right. So talk a little bit about that environment, and in particular about what ended up being a big issue, and that's interrogation techniques.
Sure.
And the black sites, the places where we had captured Al-Qaeda officials being held around the world. Talk a little bit about that experience. What went into the thinking, and how did that contribute to some difficult political situations back home?
Sure, and personal moral situations too. Yeah, so title of the book is Playing to the Edge. It is not an accidental title. It is selected because of this very dynamic. And I got my fingerprints on every controversial program our government has engaged in since 9/11. I started the surveillance program that has engendered so much commentary to October 2001. I inherited, all right, but still carried out and greatly modified the rendition, detention, and interrogation program. I and my agency pressed the Bush administration in late 07 and early 08 to really amp up the rate of targeted killings in Pakistan. All right, so, yeah, good. It's an unapologetic book, and it does explain the circumstances, explain why we did what we did, and you can probably tell from my tone, I'm still quite comfortable that what we did was effective, lawful, and appropriate. But it was not without controversy, obviously. And, you know, you didn't have to be a wingnut to disagree with them. There are good, solid Americans with whom I think I share common values who would say, no, on that one, I'm not with you, big guy. I think you went beyond where the line should be. And so one of the more controversial ones is the detention program and the interrogations. I became director in May of 2006. It was the 600-pound creature in the room. All right, and so I was able to convince the Bush administration to fundamentally change it. Number one, before the summer was out, we had emptied the black sites. All right, didn't close them, and I actually put more people in them, but we did empty them. We reduced the techniques from 13 to 6, and just to kind of give you a footnote here of interesting history, it was not President Obama who took waterboarding off the table. It was President Bush, and he did it in 2006. Yeah. All right, so we emptied the camps, reduced the number of prisoners. I only put two in, reduced the number of available techniques, only used them against one prisoner. All right, but we felt this was still an essential tool to keep America safe in these unique circumstances. But to give you, I may just dwell on the techniques a little bit. To give you a sense of the mathematics, you know, why did we change from 13 to 6? And getting rid of, frankly, some of the more harsh techniques. It wasn't because we were disowning our past. It wasn't my preempting or second-guessing the judgment of George Tenet, who was in front of me. It was simply that George had his circumstances, I had mine. And so what may have been appropriate for George in his circumstances were no longer appropriate for me and mine. We had, by 2006, we had far more penetrations of Al-Qaeda. We had a lot of sources. We had a better understanding of Al-Qaeda. And most importantly, we had a better understanding of the threat, which is something that George was just kind of reaching for and poking at in 02 and 03 when he made the judgment to do what he did. So you know, this is not my, you know, claiming I've got a higher moral authority than George Tenet, all right? My great line is, I thank God George did what he did, and a lot of other people around Washington ought to thank God that George had to make the decision too, mm-hmm. rather than their having to make the decision. One of the things that haunted us, and I mean this sincerely, given the atmosphere of the country, all right, so I say this playing to the edge, and I say we get this box, okay, and y'all expect us to play in the box, and frankly, playing to the edge is designed to say, and you want us to use the whole box. Okay. Otherwise, if I'm playing back from the edge, okay. If I play back from the edge, I probably spare myself a really tough session with Miss Pelosi, okay. But I'm not protecting you. I'm either protecting me, or more nobly, I'm protecting my agency. All right. But I'm not protecting you. So you played to the edge. And after 9/11, the box changed. I got it. No question about it. And I just told you why and why I'm not questioning the legitimacy. Our great fear, though, was if we failed you again, okay, the box that was drawn like this would be, at your insistence, like this. And so a failure on our part would not just threaten American security, but would really put at risk American values. And so we went to the edge, we played aggressively. We could disagree on any one of the things, and I honor your disagreement, but we did it for those reasons, always knowing that if we failed again, it would be a lot worse.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're listening to my conversation with General Michael Hayden. He's the former director of the National Security Agency and the CIA. This event was recorded before a World Affairs audience in San Francisco. The World Affairs Council is a membership organization. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org. And now back to our conversation.
I'm picking up on your mentioning Nancy Pelosi. In your book, you gave a lesson learned, and that related to how you go about briefing Congress, engaging them in the full story. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so if you're asking for a lesson learned, all right, one of the things I did, so I'm there summer of 06. I didn't start renditions, detentions, interrogations. I don't object. It's not my program. So I spent the summer getting a PhD on it, all right? And if by the end of the summer, I'm saying, Mr. President, what George did was right for George. We've got to make some changes. Empty the sites, reduce the techniques. One of the things I recommended was to go public with a lot of what we were doing and go absolutely full Monty on this with the Intel committees, where Ms. Pelosi would have gotten it either as a member of the committee or as Speaker of the House after the House switched hands in September. And I mentioned in the book, that's my deep regret. Right, and I'm going to be really candid with you, and we mentioned Ms. Pelosi, and we should not single her out. This is a dynamic that applies to 535 people I know, all right? And if you're going to go do something exceptionally aggressive, it is the instinct of the executive to keep congressional notification to the barest minimum required by law. And the barest minimum required by law is called the Gang of Eight. It's the chair and ranking of the two Intel committees and the senior member of both parties in each chamber. So you go tell the Gang of Eight. And we did. All right, the agency did that. And frankly, I wasn't there, it was George, but I talked to the people over there. And when they would go down and brief the members, eight, okay, just eight, top secret, can't even tell staff, no one else in the room, brief them on what we're doing with the techniques, all right? George was really nervous. Oh, man, I wonder how they're... Eh. And so when they came back from the Capitol after briefing the Gang of Eight, their first stop was always on the seventh floor in George's office. And George's, how was it? How did it go? And universally was, I'll be damned, George. The only question we got was, are you sure that's enough? From the members. Okay. When the president, the executive doesn't share it, all right, it allows the members of the Congress, and I'm just being candid with you here, okay? It allows them a political advantage to avoid the tough decisions then or later, okay? So my shorthand version is tell the whole committee and, frankly, bring in enough staff so that they understand what you're telling them so that they cannot later claim, right? In other words, tell them you're going to the edge when everyone's scared and dare them to tell you not to, rather than wait until you've made everybody feel safe again and then let them complain about what it was you did.
Let me take you to another subject, and that is basically technology more broadly, but you had to very quickly get up to speed on cybersecurity.
Yeah.
On our capabilities, and when you sort of walked into that that task of thinking less about the old tools and on very dramatic new tools, How did you gear up? How did you staff up? How did you start thinking about things differently?
So we're reflecting here, 99, 2000. I arrived at NSA, National Security Agency, Signals Intelligence, Intercepting Communications. All right, we were going down. All right, we were going down because, number one, the speed of change in global telecommunications was beyond the capacity of a government agency to keep up. The volume, variety, and velocity of modern communications were just changing so rapidly. All right. And so we had gone from an era of intercepting communications in which it was too little, too hard to get, to an era in which it was too much, too hard to understand. Okay. And so we needed to simply retool our approach to this. And it's not quite related to the question you asked, but it's important. So let me just take this minor segue. I testified in open session to the House Intel Committee in April of 2000 about this issue. All right. There isn't a civil libertarian on the planet who raised a little finger when we were intercepting Soviet high-frequency communications from Soviet strategic rocket forces in Moscow going out to the ICBM fields beyond the Urals looking for what we called words of interest, like launch, okay? The argument we made to the House Intel Committee in spring of 2000 was that the 21st century equivalent of those isolated, dedicated Soviet communications on their own separate network, the 21st century equivalent were terrorist, proliferator, and trafficker emails coexisting with yours on an integrated global telecommunication structure. And the argument we were making is the only way we could do for you in the 21st what we did for you in the 20th century was for you to be comfortable with us being in that flow, even though your stuff was skitting by. We needed the power to be in there, and we needed the trust that we wouldn't grab your email, we'd grab his. And that was a real break point in how we did this. And a lot of the controversy that we've seen in the next 15 years, which we've attached to Snowden and 9/11 and terrorism and so on, actually predates all that. It's based on a fundamental change in how humans communicate using electrons and photons. And we had to make some fundamental choices even before 9/11.
I'm going to take you beyond communication to the use of force in new ways.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking of several of the question cards are about Iran, and several of the question cards are about North Korea. And those are, and I'll get to their questions in a moment, but those are two cases where we or our friends use cyber attacks to get in the way of the development of a weapons program. You had Stuxnet in the case of Iran, where the centrifuges started spinning like mad. And you had missiles blowing up on launch pad in North Korea. Say something about, first, the capabilities we have, but secondly, what kind of regime needs to be in place for their management?
Yeah.
And I say that only because in the case of blowing up ICBMs on launchpad, you're getting dangerously near to the capability of getting in the way of nuclear controls.
Sure.
And then what happens to deterrence?
So the latter story is really very current and based on a wonderful David Sanger article in the New York Times about 2 weeks ago. All right. And frankly, you know, this is not me just saying I can't confirm or deny. This is my saying, I don't know. I've been out of government 8 years. All right. But I take the trajectory of what David's saying, and he uses the phrase, can we stop this left of launch? Okay, which means not shooting it down once it's en route, but making sure it never leaves the pad. Since that's new and I don't have a lot of background, let me talk a little bit about Stuxnet. All right, so you all understand what Stuxnet was. It was a weapon comprised of ones and zeros that infiltrated the Iranian nuclear facility at Natanz and convinced the control mechanisms there to direct the centrifuges to spin at self-destructive speeds while telling the system's monitors There's nothing interesting to see here, folks. Move along. Until you started hearing snap, crackle, and pop from the centrifuge hall, and about just under 1,000 centrifuges self-destructed. Now, our government has never confirmed who did or did not do that, and I'm not going to make news tonight. I will offer the observation, though, whoever did it was damn good, really, really good, because this is hard to do. And I actually got asked that question on 60 Minutes a couple years back. You know, General, only a couple countries could do this. Only a couple countries want to do this. Come on. And I actually said, look, it would be irresponsible of someone of my background to even speculate who may have done this. But I will add, a legion has crossed the Rubicon. We've got troops on the other side of the river now. Okay. Look, I'm the former director of this and that. Destroying 1,000 Iranian centrifuges looks like an unalloyed good to me. But another description of that is someone, almost certainly a nation state, because it's too tough to do from the basement, someone, almost certainly a nation state, during a time of peace, has just used a weapon comprised of ones and zeros to destroy what another nation could only describe as critical infrastructure. Ouch. And I actually said on 60 Minutes that, look, I get it. In no way compares in destructive power. This has the whiff of August 1945. This is a new class of weapon, and if you checked your species history, we don't have a good record of putting these things back in the box once we've taken them out.
And in the case of nuclear, we were talking about something that was only in a government's hands.
Yeah.
Whereas in the case of cyber,
that's correct. And oh, by the way, when you use a kinetic weapon, it destroys itself. When you use a weapon comprised of ones and zeros, it exists out there for others to go to school on.
So what are our options in North Korea?
There are no good options.
What's the least bad?
So if within our current definition of acceptable risk, okay, you got the caveat, within our current definition of acceptable risk, there's probably a pretty good chance that by the end of President Trump's current term, the North Koreans will be able to reach Seattle with an indigenously produced intercontinental ballistic missile carrying an indigenously produced nuclear warhead. Now, they got problems with fusing and ruggedization and miniaturization and separation. So it's probably not a high probability shot. But I'm going to Seattle tomorrow, and I'm going to take an unscientific sample as to what odds they would be comfortable with in terms of this. So this is a no-fooling big deal. Yeah. And four administrations have really tried very hard to slow this down. We have. To stop it, to at least hold them in place, and none of them have worked. So within our current definition of acceptable risk. So the follow-on question is, all right, go outside your current definition. I give you three options. One is break right. Ooh, that's getting tougher. That's actually taking steps to prevent their ability to do this. That's pretty high risk policy. The other is to break left, which is to accept the fact of a nuclear North Korea and begin to make policy peace with it. I'm afraid the second and third paragraphs in making peace with it make this just about as dangerous as option A.
Yeah.
Breaking right. There's a third option, just kind of like what we're doing now, but really amped up. And that's what I call the actions have consequences option. So we just parked THAAD in South Korea, theater high altitude air defense, driving the Chinese crazy. It's a missile defense system. It's there because the North Koreans are doing all these things. The fans of the radars reach way into Manchuria, Chinese really, really upset about it. My sense is you go to the Chinese and say, hey, I'm really sorry, big guy. It's not intended for you. It's that crazy guy over there. I get it. You're pretty uncomfortable with the radar coverage, but hey, not much we can do about it. Oh, by the way, we're thinking of putting one over here in Iwakuni in Japan, too. Okay? And you begin to simply up the torque on the Chinese, who have the best chance of influencing these guys, but they're not under their control. But you make, look, For China, North Korea is a really bad toothache. And they really don't want to go in for the root canal, which is really what they need. So they keep popping painkillers and living with the bad tooth. This you got to go do what you got to go do approach is actually making the tooth hurt more for the Chinese. So you, I mean, look, you want to get squirrely? We used to have nuclear weapons in South Korea. We still have the bunkers. We know where to put them. You can have nuclear capable ships now going in what the Koreans call the East Sea and the West Sea. Chinese call the Yellow Sea and the Japanese call the Sea of Japan. I mean, you're creating a disturbance in the force here. But remember my premise, changing our definition of acceptable risk. By the way, none of those are very attractive, are they?
Yeah. I mean, in fact, let me just take one, and that's the reintroduction of short-range nuclear weapons into South Korea.
Yeah.
Setting aside how South Korea might feel about that, is it the theory there is that it's kind of a warning to Kim?
I don't think Kim is influenceable. Yeah. Jim Clapper, the former director, National Intelligence, said something we've believed for years. These guys would be crazy to give up nuclear weapons. Okay. They watched the news too. They watched what happened to Saddam Hussein, and they watched what happened to Muammar Gaddafi after they gave up their programs. They're not giving it up.
But are you seeing the short-range weapons, therefore, as a deterrent
no,
force or
influencing usable? The Chinese? Influencing the Chinese to up the torque.
So we need the Chinese. Yeah. We agree on that.
Yeah, I mean, the option three is a carom, all right? It's not trying to directly influence the North Koreans.
So as you put yourself in the head of the Chinese, which must be basically way high up in the job description, right? Is that you're putting yourself in the heads of a potential adversary. What they have to worry about is the collapse of North Korea.
And they do. And that's what they actually fear the collapse more than the nuclearization of North Korea. By the way, the Chinese are good at this. I mean, in my last couple of jobs, I had insights into how they work through these problems. It's really impressive. Nuanced, historical, strategic, patient. Now, they've gotten a little more nationalistic in the last 4 or 5 years, kind of thumping their chest in the South China Sea, kind of un-Chinese-like, frankly, based upon what I knew. It is an adult conversation talking to the Chinese about this. Again, they fear the collapse more than they fear the nuclearization. But, I mean, you're not talking to people you can't talk to.
Yeah. Let me take you to another part of the world where collapse has been an issue. I've been struck by how different the appeal of ISIS is than Al-Qaeda's appeal. When you think about the numbers of recruits they could get in a given week or month, it's really different by pretty large factors, right? Did you feel that our intelligence agencies and our military and any aspect of our society was able to get a handle on what it is about ISIS? Because I keep thinking, it's got to be that offer of a homeland, right? I mean, what explains it?
So there's a little cause and effect here, all right? And so continue my tradition as being an equal opportunity critic. It was probably a really bad decision to go to zero in Iraq in 2011, right? Not because a residual American force was going to defeat ISIS, okay? The Americans were kind of the stopper in the sectarian bottle, all right? In essence, Iraq was not yet the integrated democracy we would hope it to be. Democracy is too strong a word. The integrated self-governing space we had hoped it would be, Sunnis, Shias, and Kurds. There was tremendous distrust. But each of the tribes, so to speak, knew that as long as the Americans were there, there were limits to what the other two tribes could do to them. You know, the Americans wouldn't let certain things happen. And so you kind of got a precondition for some modest political process going forward. When the Americans pulled out, all three factions, Sunni, Shia, and Kurd, effectively went to their respective corners and began to think the worst of the other two. With the Americans gone, they are going to do all those things I feared. Literally, when the last American boot stepped into Kuwait, and I mean this literally, when the last American boot stepped into Kuwait, Nouri al-Maliki issued an arrest warrant for murder for his Sunni vice president. And after that, it was game on. And then the stability, the equilibrium, I'm trying to choose my words carefully here without over-describing, the equilibrium we had created in Anbar with the Anbar Awakening and getting the Sunnis to actually make war on al-Qaeda, okay, began to dissolve when they had their worst dreams effectively realized that the Baghdad government was Shia and predatory against Sunnis. And then the Sunnis looked for somebody who would protect them, and it was son of al-Qaeda in Iraq. It was ISIS, and we began this devolution. And I'm sorry, that wasn't just predictable. That was inevitable. And so it was, I think, an unforced policy error in 2011 to withdraw.
We're almost able to make it through tonight without talking about Afghanistan. There was an interesting article in Today's Times pointing out that that keeps happening.
Yeah.
Right, that he did in, during the campaign, during the debates, during the president's address to a joint session, no word about Afghanistan. How do you see Afghanistan's future and our role in it?
Yeah, it's not nearly what we had hoped. And it's certainly been far more costly than we would have wanted. The commander there has asked for some more troops. He's going to get them. It's not a big force. But it's you know, we supply things to our Afghan allies that they don't have and no one else can supply. We supply logistics, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, and what we euphemistically call indirect fires. And that's artillery and air power. And so even President Obama stopped the downward slope, I think kind of harvesting the lessons of Iraq, actually loosened some of the rules of engagement for American forces so they could be more actively involved. So I think what we're going to do is we're going to throw another couple thousand GIs at it, and we're going to fight for stalemate. We're going to fight for kind of holding where we are now and then seeing where the political processes, such as they are, give Ghani a chance, where they go. Yes. That's not a very bright picture, but that's... that's real.
Let me just take you to the last question, because it inevitably comes up. And this question is, WMDs, did CIA and NSA just get it wrong?
Yep.
Why? Why? And you've got, in the book you refer to at one moment saying you've got a room full of.
Oh, yeah.
So
this is the evidence. Famous, infamous 2002 National Intelligence Estimate on Iraq weapons of mass destruction, requested by the Senate before they voted on President Bush's proposed war resolution. And so it was done at a pace faster than these are normally done. Vice President Cheney did not drive up the GW Parkway on a regular basis and slap our analysts around. No one in the White House held a gun to our head. We did this, we got it wrong. I was in the room. I voted on it. I was the head of the National Security Agency at the time. All right, and we believed it to be true. And frankly, there was just little dissent. We had two dissents, one from state and one from energy. And they were actually on small aspects. I've forgotten which one. There was a question of aluminum tubes being bought by the Iraqis. And the estimate said they're paying such top dollar. They are so high quality. These are probably tubes that would be used in the nuclear program in centrifuges. And one of them, state or energy, I've forgotten, said those tubes are not for a nuclear program and we're not sure they have a nuclear program. And the other one said the tubes are not for a nuclear program, but they sure as hell got a nuclear program. And those are the only two dissents. Okay? Chem program, bio program, check, check, check. And everyone else on the nukes except for these, you know, rather limited dissents. So I talked to Condi. She and I go back a bit. She was an intern on the joint staff, and I was a lieutenant colonel. All right, so we've got a relationship. So she turned to me in the fall of 2002. I'm director of NSA. And she says, Mike, what do you think? I said, Condi, I got a room full of evidence these guys are doing this. It's all circumstantial. Okay. Fast forward. So Mike Morrell, Mike, you've seen him on CBS. He's under contract to them. Really smart guy. He was my number three. He later became Leon's number two. So Mike's in there. Now I'm out of government. It's all about Abbottabad. It's all about Osama, right? Bin Laden. And the president liked Michael. So he kept him, President Obama. So he kept him behind. He said, Michael, in your gut, is that tall guy in the picture? Is that him or not? It's a big deal decision here, right? and Michael said, well, Mr. President, we got some people at CIA say, it's about 50-50. We got other people say it's 90-10. And the president, quite appropriate response, that ain't very useful, Michael. And so Michael elaborates, and Mr. President, everyone who played Iraq says 50-50. Everybody on this case who did nothing but Al-Qaeda says it's 90-10. And the president kind of gets this, okay. And Michael wants to be sure he doesn't have a false sense of confidence. He said, Mr. President, one more thing. Every stitch we have that tall guy's Osama bin Laden is circumstantial. And Mr. President, I was there. We had more circumstantial evidence that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction than we have that guy's Osama bin Laden. So the point I want to make is that the intel guys never get the 80-mile-an-hour curveball that doesn't break coming down the middle of the plate. They get the wicked slider on the black of the plate at the knees. I was actually, my first year as director of CIA, I was downtown talking to a group of Americans I've now since learned to call high net worth individuals, all right? And one of them says to me, General, after I'd kind of given the one hand over the world, says, General, on a scale of 0 to 10, this is post-WMD, on a scale of 0 to 10, how would you rate CIA analysis now? And I said, sir, first thing you got to understand is we don't do 8, 9, or 10. If you can get this to 8, 9, or 10, they're asking the Department of Commerce or something. Okay? They aren't asking us. And then one more point. I didn't tell the high net worth guy, but I will share with you.
I'm your low net worth.
Yeah. We hardly ever get to court of law beyond reasonable doubt anything. The purpose of intelligence is to enable meaningful action even in the face of lingering doubt. So this is not my throwing myself on the mercy of the court, all right? I already told you, we did my last conversation with Leon Panetta before I left CIA. Leon's coming in to replace me. We actually had a real friendly handoff. I said, Leon, I got one more thing. I've been reading some of your stuff from out of government. You gotta stop saying that, okay? The Bush guys didn't mislead, and Cheney didn't pressure us. Okay, we did it, Leon. It was our fault. It was a swing and a miss. Our mistake. Right? Now, we've gone to school on that. We're better because of it. But we do accept full responsibility for getting it wrong.
Join me in thanking General Michael Hayden.
Thank you.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a membership organization, and we're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. This program featured my conversation with General Michael Hayden. He's the former director of the National Security Agency and the CIA. To take part in programs like this, visit us at worldaffairs.org. The broadcast is made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. Our recording engineer is Jim Bennett. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.